Hello, my friends, and welcome back to Creepaholics. We're here with tales and stories, murders and mysteries. We tell you about the killers, the ghosts, the demons, and the witches. We let you know what really happened to those people on the nights they went missing. Or maybe stories just are unknown. You'll have to tune in to find out. So, without further ado, please welcome the Creepaholics channel with your host, Shanice.
Welcome back, Creepaholics crew, to tonight's episode. I'm your host, Shanice, and we will be covering the Natalie Ann Holloway and her disappearance. Now, it's every parent's worst nightmare when a child goes missing. But what happens when she's going on a graduation trip with 124 classmates and somehow disappears? And still, at the end of an investigation, under all the circumstances, they're left with more questions than answers. Now, before I start, I'd like to give a shout out to Nikki Gardner and Adrian. At the end of this podcast, I will let you know how you can get a shout out too. Now let's creep into it, shall we? Natalie was born on October 21st, 1986. She was the first child to be born to Dave and Elizabeth Holloway, also known as Beth. They lived in Memphis, Tennessee. Her parents would then divorce in 1993. Natalie and her younger brother, Matthew, were raised by their mother. Beth would go on to marry George Twitty. His nickname was Jug. This would happen in the 2000s. George was an Alabama businessman. Once they married, the family moved to Mountain Brook, Alabama. Natalie would graduate with honors in May of 2005 from the Mountain Brook High School. The school was located in the wealthy suburb of Birmingham. Natalie was a member of the National Honor Society. She was also associated with the school's dance club and participated in many other extracurricular activities. After high school, Natalie was headed to attend university. Now, it was the University of Alabama. She was given a full scholarship. Things were going great for her. She even pursued a pre-med track. That's very hard to do. On Thursday, May 26, 2005, Natalie and 124 of her fellow graduates from Mountain Brook High School would take a trip together as their unofficial graduation trip. They landed in Aruba for 5 days. The teenagers would be accompanied by 7 chaperones. Their trip would be fulfilled with sun-drenched beaches, drinks, and luxurious nights at Impulse nightclubs. On May 29th, 2005, Natalie would meet a 17-year-old Dutch national who lived in a nearby town called Noord. His name was Vandersloot. She met him at the hotel's casino. There was the final day of their vacation. Vandersloot would chat with Natalie, and soon would join the group to the Carlos and Charlie's bar, which is located in downtown Orgested. Vandersloot and Natalie would drink and dance. The bar would be closed at 1 a.m. Natalie would be getting into a car with Vandersloot and his two friends, Deepak and Satish, the Kalapo brothers. The three would leave together. Natalie's friends were unable to locate her after the bar. Soon, the day of the departure came. They had to return home, which was May 30th, 2005. Natalie wasn't like this. She never missed appointments or places she had to be, especially if it was her trip to go home. She was headed to university. She was excited. Natalie was not in the hotel room, but her bags and passport remained in the room. It appeared to be untouched. A chaperone would then have to make the devastating call to Beth and break the news that her daughter, Natalie, has gone missing. She has disappeared, and nobody knows where she has gone. That very night, Beth and her husband, family and friends, all flew to Aruba. They rented a jet. They began questioning the Holiday Inn, the Carlos and Charlie's bar, and then headed to Vandersloot's home in Noord. Now Vandersloot would say he did leave the bar with Natalia and the brothers, and they proceeded to drive to a lighthouse to hang out before dropping it off Natalie at her hotel. They even said that there was a security guard that seen them drop her off. So Vandersloot offered to take the group of Natalie's relatives, and point out the security guard, who allegedly helped her inside. But upon arriving, this security guard was nowhere to be found. On June 1st, 2005, that would be the first organized local search team that would be started for Natalie Ann Holloway. Now, Natalie is not determined missing yet, but 100 people, tourists, and various locals began to search for her, as Beth was terrified of where her daughter was. In a few weeks, a volunteer from Texas, Aruban police, Dutch Marines, and 3 F-16 fighter planes from the Netherlands would join the search. But still, to no prevail, they were unable to locate any sign of Natalie. She was nowhere to be found. On June 5th, 2005, the police would make their first arrest in the case. The first suspect the police would detain would be the farmer, former security guard of the hotel that had been closed for renovations. But 8 days later, he would be released. Then police would arrest Vandersloot's father, Palus, and a party boat DJ. It would be on June 9th, 2005, that Vandersloot and the two brothers would be taken into custody as well, after the 3 men were last seen with Natalia after all. After they were arrested, they were put under immense pressure. They began to change their story. The two brothers claimed that they had dropped Vandersloot and Natalie off at a nearby beach, not the lighthouse. They said that the beach was located near the Holiday Inn, but Vandersloot insisted he had left her there, and she had walked home. On July 4th, 2005, a judge would order that the two brothers be released. An announcement was also made that Vandersloot would remain held for another 60 days, but the judge gives no reason as to why. On July 17th, 2005, hair strands would be found, giving some hope to Natalie's case. The hair strands were found stuck to a piece of duct tape. The duct tape was located at the Aruba's northeast coast. It was sent to FBI's crime lab in Quantico, Virginia. There, a test would confirm that it was not Natalie. The news of this would arrive on July 28th. A tip was phoned in from a gardener on July 26th, 2005. Now, the tip claims that he had seen Vandersloot and the two brothers, and they were digging beside the Marriott Hotel. Now, this is important, because what did the police do? The police would decide to drain the pond across from the Marriott, but on July 30th, police would abandon their efforts. They had gotten a tip saying that the 3 men were digging beside the hotel. Why drain a pond? Shouldn't they be digging in the location that the gardener said he seen them? On February 16th, 2005, a civil lawsuit was served to Vandersloot and his father. They filed with the Supreme Court and with the state of New York. They were accused of juron of malice, wanton and willful disregard of the rights and safety and well-being of Natalie and claims Paulus enabled his son's predatorial behavior. But on August 3rd, this suit would soon be dismissed. Between March 1st and March 3rd of 2006, Vandersloot would go on Fox News to tell his side of the story. He would have a lengthy interview with Greta Van Susteren. It would be aired over 3 nights. Vandersloot would begin recounting his side of events. He said, "They danced, they drank in the bar, they had a good time." And he leaves with Natalie. He thus says that upon arriving at the beach, he leaves her behind, all alone, and goes home. He does address some very weird elements in his story. Like, he explains why his shoes went missing that night. Now, why would he explain that if maybe the shoes would lead to where Natalie is? If so, he quotes, "I might have lost a pair of sneakers on the beach that night. Natalie disappeared." He says in one of the statements, lead investigator, Roy Trump, the 17-year-old suspect describes a white and blue pair of shoes that were brand new. Quote, "He lost them in the area of a fisherman's hut, but we are looking other places, including the pond," investigator Roy Trump explains. The following December 14th, 2006, Natalie's parents would begin to take legal action against the two brothers. Beth and George Twitty would also have Dave Holloway and begin to take aim at the two suspects. They filed a wrongful death suit against the two brothers in the Los Angeles Superior Court. But however, due to the location of the crime in Aruba, it would be dismissed by the judge due to the lack of jurisdiction on June 1st, 2007. November 21st, 2007 would come, and the two brothers and Vandersloot would once again be arrested. Vandersloot would be arrested at the Netherlands, where he attended school. The two brothers were then held in Aruba after new incriminating evidence was found. This new evidence, unfortunately, would fail and not move this case forward in defining Natalie. So again, all three suspects would be released on December 7th. December 30th rolls around. Divers would begin to investigate the fish traps just off the Aruba coast to search for Natalie and any sign of her. An American search vessel and a remote-operated vehicle would find photos of a human skull, but it would become a dead end. The divers would exclaim that this was not relevant to her case. A Dutch reporter would take it upon himself to set up a hidden camera. This reporter was Peter R. Deveres. On February 3rd, 2008, he would catch on video Vandersloot saying what had actually happened that night. Vandersloot says Natalie collapsed when they were together on the beach, and he took it upon himself to try and revive her, but was unable. So Vandersloot says he had a friend come and help dispose of her body from a boat off the coast. He was afraid of getting in trouble. When Vandersloot found out he had been recorded, he then denied his confession and claims. He says he was lying at the time of the interview, just wanted some fame. March 29th, 2010, an email would be sent to Beth's lawyer, John Q. Kelly, claiming Vandersloot would release Natalie's body location, but only if an exchange is made of $25,000 up front and another $225,000 to come. Kelly would relay the message to the police. The FBI soon would agree to the exchange, and the lawyer, John Q. Kelly, would meet Vandersloot. On May 10th, 2010, in Aruba, he would take the $10,000 with him, and he was led to a house, where he was told his father buried Natalie in its foundations. That day, another $15,000 would be wired to his bank account in the Netherlands. But again, on Vandersloot's account, he would say, "I'm lying. I just needed the money to take part in a poker tournament in Peru." No arrest would be made, though, even with the police and FBI's involvement. It would be 5 years after the disappearance of Natalie that Vandersloot would be in the news again. But not for Natalie's case. Vandersloot had killed a young woman while he was in Peru. He had killed a 21-year-old woman in his hotel room in Lima, Peru. Her name was Stefani Flores Ramirez. Vandersloot gave the hotel strict instructions not to enter his room. So her body actually wasn't discovered for a little while. Vandersloot would eventually be arrested in Chile on July 3rd, 2011. He had changed his hair to a sporty red haircut, tried to disguise himself. He was found in a taxi near Coastal City. He would be arrested and taken back to Lima to be held in a high-security prison. June 27th, Vandersloot would be held accountable for the charge of the U.S. wire fraud and extortion when he attempted to acquire $250,000 from Natalie's mother. The suspect was not arrested after the wire payment, though. The police were asked why they did not do that, and they claimed they had insufficient evidence to do so, even though the lawyer showed up and gave the money, and there was paperwork of a wire transfer to his bank in the Netherlands. Police say there was no evidence. And there's the email. The email states what he was doing and what he wanted. Vandersloot pleads guilty on January 11th, 2012, to the murder of Flores. He confesses he would say, "I wanted from the first moment to confess sincerely," he says in court. He also says, "I'm truly sorry for this act. I feel very bad." But the defense would claim that his actions were from extreme psychological trauma, which was suffered from the long-running Holloway case. But prosecutors claim he only killed Ramirez because of her winnings that she got from the casino in Peru, not because of his so-claimed trauma. Sadly, on January 12, 2012, at the behest of Dave Holloway, he, against all wishes of Natalie's mother, decided to officially declare Natalie Ann Holloway as deceased. By an opposition, he claims that there is no proof, no indication that she is still alive. So having absent proof or indication that she is not dead, the judge agreed. Beth always wanted to leave the door open in hopes that she may find her, but that was not the case. Now that she is declared dead, her case may never be opened unless her body is found. Vandersloot would be sentenced on January 13, 2012. He was sentenced to 28 years in prison and ordered to pay $75,000 in reparations to the victims' families while working behind bars. But as for Natalie's family, they still hope Vandersloot will be punished and convicted for what he did to Natalie that night. As for now, Natalie Ann Holloway remains missing and declared deceased. Unfortunately, Beth and Dave and George, they never know what happened to Natalie that night. Is Vandersloot lying? Are the two brothers holding the key piece to the evidence? Why did the police not charge him after the wire transfer? And when the gardener phoned in the tip, the police should have dug up the ground. Still, there's no reports saying that the ground was ever touched. Nobody dug it up. Nobody has searched to see if the gardener's tip was actually correct. Instead, they decided to drain a pond. Then, there's the thing about the white and blue shoes. If they're found, is that actually the site of her burial? Is that maybe the key evidence to what happened? Does somebody know more than they're leading on? Why did the police not do their job fully? There's so many questions left, and so little answers. And we may never know what actually happened to Natalie. And as for her parents, I hope you find peace and eventually find out what happened. If you know anything about Natalie's case or her disappearance, please contact the FBI or Crime Stoppers hotline. You may never know. You may hold the key missing piece to somebody. Somebody may know. Somebody may have seen something. Somebody may have caught something on video. But as for now, it remains a mystery. Well, that's all I have for you tonight, Creepaholics crew. I'm your host, Shanice, and that was a very wild case. So, like I said in the beginning, I would tell you how you can get a shout out. If you would like a shout out, just hit that like or subscribe button. You can also email me at creepaholicsvsshanice, which is C-H-A-N-I-C-E, at gmail.com. You can also head on over to my Facebook page and send me a message. I'll even sit there and chat with you for a bit. If you have a case that you want to look up, or know of an episode or a future story that you'd really love to hear that no one else has done, then send the topic over. I'll be happy to research it for you. Down below, I'll also post information where you can send me a voice memo, and you can also go on my Anchor page, where there's lots of cool stuff on there and other podcasts you can check out. I'm on 7 different platforms. I also have a webpage called wordpress.com/creepaholics. You can also find me on Instagram and, of course, what we all know and love, YouTube. I have now opened my YouTube channel. Check out my videos on there. Next week, the two podcasts that have been opened, like uploaded the last 2 weeks, are Amityville Horror and our Natalie case will be uploaded on the YouTube channel, so tune in to that because that is going to be a video you are not going to want to miss if you have not heard this podcast. If you have and you just really enjoyed it and want to see it in video form, then look for the notification. Thank you so much to everybody who has listened to me, and I'm very happy with my followers and my content. It has been going really far. There's a lot of support going on behind it, and I'm very happy. So without further ado, keep creeping it real, Creepaholics crew. Until next time, stay safe.
Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.